There was something elfin about her. It was as though the vibrations of her personality were graduated as to pass almost uninhibited through those around her. Arthur Magida, in his book, Codename Madeleine. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is author Arthur Magida, and we're discussing his Pulitzer Prize-nominated book in the biography memoir category, Codename Madeleine, A Sufi Spy in Nazi-Occupied Paris. Given her delicate and introspective disposition, it would seem incongruous that Nur Inayat Khan, imbued with the spiritual wisdom of her famous father, would join the British Special Operations Executive and serve as an espionage agent in Nazi-occupied Paris. But serve she did, and at one time was the only wireless operator in half of France who sent critical information to London. This is her story, a story of courage and a story of honor. Arthur, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Thank you, Hal. I'm delighted to be here.
Arthur.
And also thank you for that wonderful question.
Oh, well, thank you. But let me ask you, who is this fascinating woman? Tell us something of her background and particularly of her relationship with her father.
Certainly. Thank you. And as you said, Nur embodied honor, and Nur embodied courage, and Nur also embodied the teachings of her father, Hazrat Inayat Khan, an enormously influential and quite famous Sufi master. Hazrat Inayat Khan came to the West from India in 1910. His original intention was to study Western music here, and not long after that, to return to India. It didn't work out that way. I would say about a year after he came to the U.S., he began teaching Sufism, first on the West Coast, then on the East Coast, primarily in New York. He was very adept at translating Sufi teachings for Western students. And he met Ora Baker, Nora's mother, in New York City, or his brother, Pierre Bernard, a totally fictitious name, operated a very early yoga type of studio in Manhattan. He had Hazrat Inayat Khan teach some classes. Hazrat and the woman who became Nur's mother, Ora, fell in love with each other. They eventually eloped to Europe, and they first lived in England, then France, finally Moscow, and Nur Inayat Khan was born in Moscow January 1st, 1914. That's where her father was performing at that moment. Family eventually moved back to England, from England to France, 1921, 1922 or so. And Nur grew up in what was essentially a small town directly opposite Paris in this Sufi cocoon. The family lived in what was essentially a quasi-palace on a hilltop overlooking the city of Paris. And the house was swarmed with students of Hazrat Inayat Khan during the summer. Good part of the rest of the year, Hazrat Inayat Khan would be touring either Europe or the United States. But the children, and there were four of them, including Nur, were imbued with Sufism, and especially imbued with the creed of serving others, loving others, devoting yourself to others, and in her words, sacrificing yourself for others. And indeed, she relished the joy, her word, of sacrifice. So the woman who you said eventually went off to join the SOE, this British secret agency, was steeped in Sufism, steeped in faith, steeped in devotion to others. And in fact, her father said that the essence of spirituality and mysticism is readiness to serve the person next to us. Nor did that her entire life. She served, and she served wholeheartedly, and she served without any reservation.
Well, what attracted her to the SOE or the British Special Operations Executive? And what in the world was that during the Second World War?
Yes, what was the SOE? Well, Winston Churchill, about a year or so into the war, decided that more needed to be done, especially to encourage resistance within some of the occupied countries in Europe. So he devised a secret unit that would engage in sabotage when necessary, that would coordinate Western efforts, Allied efforts to defeat the Nazis with whatever native resistance operations were doing. And usually these small clusters of SOE agents consisted of a leader, a courier who sort of went from one unit to another, or from the resistance back to the SOE units, and a radio operator. Nora was a radio operator, the first female radio operator. The SOE flew into France, and that was in June 1943. You asked what attracted Nora to the SOE. Nor had never heard about the SOE. Hardly anybody in England knew about the SOE. It was top secret. Nor had been serving in another branch of the service in England. She was what was known as a Fanny, and she helped develop her own radio skills, but that was primarily to help RAF pilots, Royal Air Force pilots, who were in training. And eventually, of course, they would go over to Europe and they would bomb or they would strafe. And part of their success was due to Nora because she was a very good radio operator. Others in that service learned about Nora's experience in France. She lived there for 20 years in Suresnes, this town opposite Paris. She was fluent in French. She knew the city of Paris very, very well, and she was a superb radio operator. That person referred Nora to the SOE. SOE then invited Nora in for an interview. Of course, she had no idea why or what. And the interview went quite well, except at one point, the interviewer noted that, you know, Nora had an Indian background. Her father was Indian. And she was asked what Nora thought of Gandhi's efforts to free India of the British, these colonizers. She said she sympathized greatly with what Gandhi was doing, but this is a war, and this is a war for the security and the safety of humanity, and she would devote her full efforts to that. When the war was over, perhaps she would go to India and assist Gandhi. But her full efforts right now, her full intentions were to engage in this war, defeat Hitler, eradicate Europe of the scourge.
Well, she did not have a super smooth time through her training and getting accepted by the SOE. What happened? What did they think of her?
Some of her trainers had great respect for her. Others thought she did not belong in the SOE. She should not be sent to Europe. One even reported to his superiors that Nora was, quote, not overburdened with brains. Noor had more than her share of brains, more than her share of creativity, more than her share of courage. One of the reasons this guy wrote that was that he did not like the idea of, you know, women doing men's work. And what could be more masculine than being a secret agent in France? And others who Noor was being trained with noted that Noor was a little bit despondent at some point. She seemed a little bit distracted, perhaps depressed. So Vera Atkin, who kept an eye on all of the women who were being trained by the SOE, invited Noor to come in to London for a lunch. And, you know, Noor said, Vera said what she had heard about Noor during training. And Noor said, well, actually, her spirits were quite good, but she was still worried about leaving her mother, to whom she was greatly devoted. Noor asked Vera that if Noor was caught by the Germans, not to tell her mother. She did not want to have her mother worry more than she should. The SOE, Noor said, should only tell her mother that something bad had happened to Noor if indeed she was eventually killed. With that, Vera Atkins totally agreed. Noor felt much better. She returned to the base where she was being trained. She went through another 6 weeks or so of training and was flown to France the evening of June 16,
1943. Those trainers and those officials at the SOE that supported her, I think, like Vera Atkins, I believe. What Arthur, did they see in her that said to them, no, this woman will be able to do this job? What did they see in her?
I believe they saw resilience, determination. Her courage, of course, had not yet been exhibited and would not be until she got to France. But they also saw somebody who excelled at operating a radio and knew code better than most anybody else in the SOE. And of course, she knew French and she knew Paris. So that was a combination they could not resist. And also they were desperate for radio operators in France. So they had to send Noor, even though some of them had severe reservations. One concern, and they did not tell Noor about this, was that if they sent this young woman, Noor at that point was 29, she would probably have a lifespan of 6 weeks in France. The average span of service for SOE radio operators in France was 6 weeks. Noor ended up serving 4 months before she was caught by the Gestapo.
Why 6 weeks, Arthur? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but 6 weeks did intrigue me as I read your book, because I looked at all the work that went into training particularly the radio operators, and to go and have a life of only 6 weeks. I just made me think about the lifespan of these people and their commitment. And when you say 6 weeks, does that mean that they're highly likely to be captured within 6 weeks, or are they going to be rotated back to London in 6 weeks?
No, if only it was that easy and they would be rotated. No, after 6 weeks, the average radio operator was caught by the Gestapo. There weren't rotations going on. It wasn't like Vietnam where they would have R&R after a certain amount of time. No, they were caught invariably they would be taken to a facility in the center of Paris, a mansion on Avenue Foch, a very glamorous boulevard in Paris that the Germans had commandeered. I will tell you what happened to Nora when she got there. And then I'll answer your question a little bit further about what happened to these people. Early October, Nora was taken to 84 Avenue Foch. She was taken to the fifth floor. She was
Let's wait a minute, if you don't mind, and we'll get to that whole discussion of her captivity and what happened in her captivity. But I find it very, very interesting that 6 weeks and most were captured, and we're going to talk in a moment about Noor's capture as well, and how that came about. But in a much more than a contextual way, tell me about the radio itself, because the radio, the wireless, really played a role, a significant role in the way Noor operated in Paris. So tell me about the radio itself and her skill at transmission, because you go over a lot of interesting things in the book. Her style of sending, I guess that was called the fist, and how that worked, and simply this wireless. What was a wireless back then?
Yeah, that's just an antiquated term. We don't use that any longer. But the wireless that Noor was given was developed by technicians within the SOE. And this was a relatively compact radio transmitter, radio receiver, a battery, headphones, and a whole bunch of knobs and buttons. For its time, it was highly advanced. For its time, it was extremely lightweight. What Noor was given weighed 30 pounds. We have these little devices. I'm speaking on one of them right now. God knows how many ounces this weighs, and we can cram it into our pocket. She had to lug this around Paris in a suitcase. Other radio operators would keep it where they were living, in whatever safe house they had found. Noor kept hers with her almost wherever she went. Once on the Paris subway, she was stopped by two German soldiers. Said, "Ma'am, what are you carrying?" Because they'd heard that there were these secret agents who were carrying suitcases and they should be arrested on the spot. And Noor, here's another indication of her bravery and her courage and her creativity on the spot, opened it just a crack to let the Germans look in. And she said, "This is a film projector. See, there are all those tubes." And the Germans felt abashed and ashamed that they had stopped this young woman on the subway and metro. But yes, you referred to these fists. Every operator had their own way of using their telegraph key. They would press it a certain way. They would hold it down for a certain length of time. There wasn't a uniform way of using these keys. The way they used it was called their fist. The Germans eventually were able to determine each agent's fist. And that was one way they were able to catch some of them. That was also the way that the SOE knew that messages were indeed coming from the agents they had sent to Europe and not being used by Germans who caught some of these machines.
Well, another aspect that I think plays an important role in her work and in your book as well is the antenna. We think of antennas as these short little things that that stick up and telescope. But this antenna, I just imagined reading your book that this antenna is an amazing deficit for or liability for the radio operator. Well, tell us a little about this antenna.
Well, you're right. These days when we think of an antenna, we might look at the back of a car, we see a little metal stub sticking up. Knorr's antenna, attached to this 30-pound radio, was a 70-foot length of wire. That handicapped her all the time. Somewhere in my book, I refer to it as an albatross. She could not transmit without this antenna, all 70 feet of it extended to its full length. There's a great story about Nora living in one of her safe houses. She had to send a message. This was not the safe house where she usually transmitted from. Usually she went elsewhere. But this message was of immediate and paramount importance to London. So she went downstairs to the yard next to this apartment building. She extended the antenna. She was having some trouble with it. And suddenly she heard a voice with a German accent behind her. And this man said, "Ma'am, can I help you?" And Nora turned around and there was a Gestapo agent. He helped her string it up. Then she went back to her first or second floor apartment and sent this message to London. Nor soon told a very good friend of her about this. And the friend said, "No, first of all, you have to get out of that building." It was literally teeming with Germans. Secondly, the friend said, "What was that man thinking? He could have arrested you on the spot." And Nor said, "Well, possibly he thought I was using it to tune into BBC transmissions of jazz, and even some Germans like jazz." And other times when Nora needed to extend this antenna, members of the resistance would drive them, or drive Nora with her radio to the countryside. They would extend the antenna into a field that they parked next to. Nora would go back into the car, send messages from there. So yes, it was a nuisance, it was a liability, it was a headache, and if they could have invented a smartphone, life would have been so much easier.
Well, and a GPS though would have been a huge liability for these agents in terms of being able to track them. But the Germans did have a way of finding where they were while they were transmitting, I understand.
Yeah, the Germans were very clever, as Germans are, especially with technology. They had these devices that could detect radio signals. Sometimes they would miniaturize them, and Gestapo agents would walk with very small versions of them under their raincoats, and they would listen very intently on earphones for these signals. Sometimes that was the way they were able to determine what building they were coming from. Other times they would have vans with larger versions of this equipment, and they would drive through certain neighborhoods. And as they did that, other Germans would turn off electricity. So when a signal stopped, they would often know what building it was coming from because the van would have been right outside there, and that would be a building without electricity at that very moment.
So in order to avoid detection, moved around quite a bit and carried with her her 30-pound. 30 pounds doesn't sound like much, but when you carry it around all day in a suitcase, I would imagine it can become it can become quite a task. And so again, in order to avoid detection, she did move around quite a bit. And part of her moving caused her, if I read right, Arthur, caused her to break at least one of the rules. And that was not to contact people that you had known in the past. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Certainly. But if we could back up just one moment, you said, you know, carrying a 30-pound suitcase may not be that hard a task. I would not want to carry a 30-pound suitcase.
Oh, no, I think it's a very hard task. I think 30 pounds gets very heavy after a while.
And especially when you're anxious and you're fearful and an agent might nab you at any moment. And also, Nora was rather slight, about 5'4". She barely weighed 100 pounds. So for her to lug this suitcase of a radio around almost every single day must have been extremely taxing. But yes, she broke one of the key rules that every SOE agent had been instructed with. Do not contact anybody you knew before the war. That was so the other person, the one they contacted, would not blow their cover. By mid-August or so, Nora began to realize that the Gestapo had some glimmers of who she was, what she was doing. They didn't yet know what she looked like, but they were honing in on her. And also it was getting harder to find safe houses. So she went across the river to Suren, where she had lived before the war. She went to the street around the corner from where her family had lived. And it's very good she did not go to the family's home because 28 Gestapo agents were living there. But she went from door to door to door up the street around the corner. First home she knocked on, woman said, "Goodness, Babuli," that was the nickname she was known as in that neighborhood, "what are you doing here?" And Nora almost matter-of-factly said, "The British have sent me. I'm here to help out with the invasion. Can I use your home to send messages?" And this woman said, "No, it's much too dangerous." And Nora continued to try other homes up that same street. She finally found home. Her best friend, mother were in, and Nora sent maybe 8-10 messages from that home over various days. But what Nora did not know when she went back to this neighborhood, where I have been 4 times now, is that that entire block where she ended up sending messages back to London was teeming with Gestapos. Gestapo agents had taken over 17 homes on that street. There were about 37 living there. About 2 blocks over, there were 17 more Gestapo agents. So every time she returned to Suren, every time she returned to this particular block, she was surrounded by Germans. And any one of them would have loved to have caught Nor and not had gone.
There was a piece that you wanted to read for us, Arthur.
Certainly. And this relates in particular to what we were just talking about, to Nor's realization that almost everybody else in her cell had been caught, that essentially she was on her own, that so much of what she had learned from her father had to come into play. "Do not spare yourself in the work which you must accomplish," he taught her. "Do not neglect those who depend upon you." This was part of Sufi chivalry. So in my book, in the 10th chapter, in fact, at the beginning, I write, "Nor knew that we pay a price in life, the price we pay to receive life. If paying that price was not, as she said, the greatest joy, the highest and most inconceivable joy, then it was not a willing offering. Giving, in fact, was so fundamental to Noor that she called it the beginning of the inner path. And it was authentic only if we are prime to give our offering before it is expected of us. The best and the truest giving was an anticipation of the other, a clairvoyance that sprang so reflexively from our depth and our marrow that it was shorn of artifice and free of ruse. For that to occur, Noor declared, it had to be genuine. The heart, she wrote, must be broken in order for the real to come forth, an unadorned, unstained emanation of truth and of love. And that quote from Noor, the heart must be broken in order for the real to come forth, I found in a rare manuscript by Noor in her own handwriting. And it is my favorite sentence by Noor. It is my favorite thought by Noor. That describes her in her own words. In World War II and the Nazis and what they were doing to people in all of these occupied countries, Jews and gypsies and Catholics and gay people and more, broke Noor's heart, and the real came forth. And she went back to France when she could have easily stayed in England. Her heart was broken, and she came to France to serve. And that, I believe, is also highly relevant to our moment today. For many of us, our hearts are breaking. For many of us, the real is coming forth. And for many of us right now, action is called for.
Well, I certainly agree with you on that, Arthur. The other thing that I found in that regard is that even though her father was both a theologian and a mystic. He was described as somewhat as a fuzzy mystic because he believed that we remain in contact with the world, that we do not separate ourselves. Thus Noor could do this job in Paris. But could you say something about that?
Certainly. In fact, Noor's father, Hazrat Inayat Khan, had encouraged her to look at humanity without, quote, thinking they are German or English or French. They are equally dear to the awakened soul. He wrote, to them, judgment day does not come after death. For them, every day is a judgment day. Yes, he was not the type of mystic who encouraged his family or his students to distance themselves from the world. He encouraged them to be in this world, to serve others, because there's no distinction between us and others. So when he says without thinking they're German or English or French, he means in a sense that Noor would not be fighting the Germans or fighting the English or the French. She was fighting for humanity. To him, truth, and this is from him, in fact, in his words, truth is all the religion there is. And the truth is that we are one, we are unified, and we cannot make any distinctions between that. And I'm also stunned that here's this young woman who went to France to fight the Nazis, who had also been taught, bear no malice against your worst enemy. 77 years or so after she was killed, I cannot imagine how anybody anywhere in Europe could have confronted the Nazis and been faithful to that admonition, bear no malice against your worst enemy. It sounds wildly ideal to me, although I have complete respect for it. And I know that if I had encountered a Nazi anywhere, I would not have restrained my malice.
Well, unfortunately, I have to agree with you there. It's very difficult. In fact, you talk in your book about forgiveness in one place, and it relates to this lack of malice, I'm sure. But what does forgiveness mean in this context? How do you forgive? As one person in your book says, how can you even understand what is happening here, much less forgive what is happening?
Yeah, and you know, it's not far-fetched that many members of the SOE or many members of the resistance that Noor encountered would have had difficulty understanding her, because they were coming from such distinct and unique poles. Some unleashed their malice, some refused to forgive. Noor was taught to bear no malice, and Noor was taught to forgive. And the incident perhaps you're referring to was when she was possibly betrayed by a member of the resistance. Other resistance kept insisting to Noor that this man had betrayed her. She should not forgive him in any way. She should not come near him in any way. He should be persona non grata, and they should treat him even worse than that if they encountered him. Noor said, we must not judge him. We cannot judge him. She refused to. She kept repeating that. We must not judge. We must not judge. To Noor, you could not judge because we could not understand another individual's plight. She speculated with these members of the resistance. Well, maybe the Germans had caught his wife and they were threatening to harm her. Maybe they had caught his young son and they were threatening to harm him. To her dying day, she refused to bear malice against anyone.
It seems, though, that it was something as banal as money that caused him to betray her.
Yes, she was betrayed. Well, this individual, I think, was basically threatened in many ways by the Gestapo. In fact, at one point, a member of the resistance had called up that person's home. A strange voice answered, and it was pretty apparent that they were doing this with her son. But eventually, October 43, Moore was betrayed, and this time for money and or for jealousy. Sister of somebody who was deeply in the resistance called the Gestapo, told them where they could find Noor, gave the Gestapo Noor's address. And I said she either did it for money or for jealousy. I believe she did it for both. This is wartime Paris. Everybody needed money, probably. And there was quite a bounty on Noor's head. But also, this woman had realized that ever since Noor arrived in France, mid-June 1943, nobody was paying any attention to her. Here's Noor, quite pretty. Here's Noor, rather mysterious. All the males who this woman knew were suddenly attending to Noor and not to her.
I just keep living with that number, Arthur. 6 weeks. Noor was betrayed, and that's how the Gestapo caught her, finally, despite her disguises and moving from place to place. It took a betrayal. A lot of the agents that were in France, were they primarily betrayed? Is that the way they were captured by the Germans?
There was a lot of betrayal that went on, yes. And this is wartime. The Gestapo was ruthless. We've all heard about how they treated citizens in occupied countries. And also, this is France, where we know it was a very divided population. Some were collaborators, some were bystanders, some tried to pay as little attention as possible to what was going on in their own civic backyards. But yeah, and also a lot of these cells were quite porous. Sometimes the Gestapo or collaborators would infiltrate them, and they easily and handily turned over members to the Germans. So this wasn't very rare.
Well, Noor is captured, and she's taken to Avenue Foch. Tell us what happened to her in her captivity.
That first day, as I said, she was taken, she was interrogated. By German standards, it was very tame interrogation. The Germans quickly realized this is a woman who is highly stubborn and highly principled, and she did not reveal anything to them. They had their hopes up that they would soon gain something from her. But they were about finally to show her to her cell on the fifth floor of Avenue Foch, and she said she needed to go to the restroom. They pointed to where it was at the end of the corridor. Noor went in there. She was about to close the door entirely. There was a small brick that prevented her from doing that. She removed it. The Germans came over and said, no, that brick must stay. We always need to see what somebody is doing in here. Noor, being insistent and being modest, insisted that the brick be removed. The Germans removed it. She was in there for quite a while. Finally, another member of the Gestapo went to another room on the same side of that building, opened the window, and he saw Noor balancing on a rain gutter five floors up, trying to escape. Very quietly, he talked Noor back into the building. And there she collapsed in tears. You know, before, when she was being interrogated, she said, shoot me, do anything you want to with me. And now she couldn't even execute a proper escape from 84th Avenue Foch. They took her to her cell. She calmed down a bit. That evening, the prime interrogator, who spoke very good English, invited her to his office. He had dinner brought up for her. She refused to eat anything. She did smoke some cigarettes. But basically, I believe this was an attempt by him to show Noor that he was a reasonable German, not like all the other Germans she had heard about. So that was her first day there. And over the succeeding weeks, they would try to interrogate her day after day after day. They would be frustrated. They would get angry. She never, never revealed anything to them.
Excuse me. So this was the easy treatment, though, this period of her captivity. Is that right? And what were the Germans trying to accomplish with this form of the treatment of prisoners?
Well, you know, with Noor at least, what they wanted from her was some of the passwords she used when she was sending messages to England. They wanted to know who else remained in the cell that she had worked with, how they could contact her, who the members of the resistance were that she was working with. They wanted to know how the SOE was functioning. The more details they got, the better for them. Elsewhere in this building, on the second floor, in fact, some members and some resistance were eventually tortured what we now call waterboarding went on in one of those rooms. But Noor, throughout her entire stay at 84 Avenue Foch, got what you just called the easy treatment. And part of that, I believe, was that she was a female. Part of it, I believe, was that quite soon, the Germans gained great respect for her. They had a little bit of knowledge about her Sufi background. But in addition to that, she comported herself with great dignity. And they had met very few members of the SOE, or indeed of the resistance, who were as taciturn as Noor, and as honorably taciturn as Noor. She never revealed a single iota of information that the Germans could use for their benefit.
And then she tried to...
Go ahead,
Arthur.
It was a second escape attempt. This was late November 1943, and actually it was the same day that Americans were celebrating Thanksgiving. That evening, Noor and two other prisoners tried to escape by going up. There was actually no way it could escape from 84 Foch by going down. There were too many Germans. I had tried to escape by racing down to the second, third floor. He grabbed a gun from Germans, shot some of them. He jumped down to the street, broke a leg. They shot him when he was down there. These guys had the brilliant idea of going upward. So there were skylights in each cell. Noor, the two fellows, went through their skylights, through a series of balconies and ropes. They worked their way down to the street, the rear of 84 Avenue Foch. The Germans caught them fairly quickly, and they took them back to 84. Gestapo, who ran this building, was incensed. He thought he had treated each one of them quite kindly, and they should have respected that, and they should never have escaped from 84 Avenue Foch. He gave them a choice. Each of you can stay here if you promise to never try to escape again. Don't give me that promise, you will be sent to Germany. One of these men promised not to escape. He survived the war at 84. The other two, Noor and the resistance leader, Leon Fay, could not make that promise. Leon had already escaped quite successfully from three other German prisons, and he had a great sense, like Noor, of honor and integrity. Noor could not take that vow because she was taught never to lie. Truth is the religion that she followed. So by not fibbing, by not promising not to escape, she was sent the next day by train to a prison in Germany. She was there for 10 months in solitary and in chains, wrist to wrist and ankle to ankle, and both sets of chains chained to each other. She was given nothing to read. She couldn't talk to anybody or see anybody. That's what the Germans called night and fog. These people were shorn of their identity. They were shorn of their pride. They were shorn of their humanity.
When did she finally get out of those chains? And before you tell us that, Arthur, what sustained her being what of her father's teaching or what of her own belief sustained her during that period of isolation and both confinement in a room and confinement by chains?
I have wondered about that for the last 3.5 years since I've been working on this book. And quite frankly, we will never be certain. Shortly after I began this book, I did an interview with Pirzia, one of Noor's nephews. He too is a Sufi master and teacher. At that point, he was living in upstate New York. I even had not interviewed what sent her. what helped her was the father's teachings, with this kind of scripture. And he sent me a verse from the Bhagavad Gita that he had heard help Noor. And, you know, it was a reasonably well translated verse, but I was curious about how that compared to translation I had. So I pulled my copy of the Bhagavad Gita off my shelf. This was done by a very well esteemed Don at Oxford. I flipped through it. I finally found the verse. What was rather odd was that I had not opened my Bhagavad Gita for 25 or 30 years. 25 or 30 years ago, with pencil, I had put brackets around only one verse in my Gita. And it was the same verse that possibly helped Noor. 2 weeks after that, I went to upstate New York to interview Pirzia. Interview went on for perhaps an hour and a half. I pulled my Gita out of my backpack. Halfway through, I thought Zia would get a kick out of seeing that. I finally found the page. Just as I'm about to hand it to him, I noted not only 25, 30 years ago had I put brackets around this verse, but I had also written in the margins, selfless work, which is what this verse is about and what Noor's life was all about. Selfless work equals liberty. Then I handed it to Pirzia, and he almost shrugged and he said, well, of course, because Noor's last word at Dachau before she was executed was liberty. She had also written before the war about solitude. I have some of her writings, and she thought through solitude, we can find ourselves. But she also wrote before that, the darkness will come. So at Forsheim, this prison in Germany, she had solitude and she had darkness, but she also, I believe, had much more aloneness than she ever anticipated.
You talk a little bit about her sacred honor. Tell us something about her sacred honor.
Well, part of that takes us back to her father, and part certainly to herself. There were two types of honor during the war. The Germans' honor, the Nazis' honor. The Germans swore honor and loyalty to Adolf Hitler. Noor's honor was rooted in everything her father taught. In fact, he even said, never forsake your honor. No matter the cost, your honor is sacred. Truth was sacred, honor was sacred, duty was sacred. Duty was service, and service was mysticism and spirituality, and both of those together are life.
But you said that in terms of her honor and her father's honor, that Sufi honor, and I find this very interesting, quite frankly, for today. You said that Sufi honor rested on compassion, truth, courage, on appreciating the sacredness of life.
Yes, and contrast that to German honor, which consisted of never straying from the horrors of Nazism and never varying from the demands of Adolf Hitler.
Well, you said in your book, because I think this is prescient. You said in your book that Hitler said it was the time, this was the Nazi honor, this was a time to defend the strong against the weak, to stop all the crocodile tears for the poor and the humiliated, and to free mankind from the yoke of reason.
Yes, I do say that, and thank you. I'm looking at that right now. Yes, that was Hitler. Hitler had no empathy, no compassion for the poor and the humiliated. Hitler had no concern for the weak. If anything, he wanted to trample the weak. And Noor and her father and the whole Sufi community to this day care about the weak. If you are not one with the weak, then you're certainly not weak. If you're not one with the weak and the humbled and the humiliated, you are not serving truth, because the poor, the weak, the humiliated are one with us as well. There's no distinction and there are no walls. And yes, Sufiana rested on compassion, truth, courage, on appreciating the sacredness of life. And everything to Noor was sacred. And the only thing sacred to a Nazi was Adolf Hitler. They elevated him to a deity. To Noor, there was only one deity, and that deity was life. And Noor devoted herself to life. In fact, a friend of mine, a very good friend, while talking about Noor early on, my work in this book, was convinced that Noor had a death wish. And I he's a child psychologist. I kept scolding him and said, Noor did not have a death wish. If anything, Noor had a life wish. She wanted to foster life, continue life. The Nazis wanted to eradicate and end life.
Well, I would suggest also that as part of that, thinking back again to her father's mysticism, she had an engagement wish. She wanted to be engaged in life. She wanted to be part, not a death wish, but to be part of it, to be immersed in it. And it seems to me what I get from your book is that she was immersed in life. She was engaged in the moment and in what was happening.
Yes. And somewhere in my book, I call her father a messy mystic.
Yes, you do.
You know, he embraced the messiness of life. He said, oh, it's easy to be an angel. You know, anybody can go to a mountaintop and meditate. Well, I can't. I would be bored after a while. But you can be an angel there. But it's very difficult, he taught, to be a human and deal with all the demands on us and all the frustrations upon us. Noor dealt with those demands. Noor was not determined to be an angel. Noor was determined to be here and to be now. And yes, to be fully engaged.
Arthur, people would say that this wonderful book of yours is about Noor Inayat Khan and her work as a spy in Paris. And of course, they would be right. Others would say it's a book about courage, and that is certainly true. But I'd like to suggest that it is mostly a book about honor. And honor, as Noor's father said, that rested on compassion, truth, courage, and on appreciating the sacredness of life. Listen, thank you very much for joining me today in this discussion of your excellent book and the honor of this woman, Noor, and her engagement in life. Arthur Magida, congratulations again for your Pulitzer Prize nomination for your book, Code Name Madeleine. Noor Inayat Khan stands as an example of courage and honor for all of us. And thanks to all of you for joining us today on Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.